You see the lawyer?
Not today. I have to go on Monday, you know, after work.
He been to see Fonny?
No. She sighed and took off her hat and put it on the TV set. I picked up the shopping bag and we walked into the kitchen. Mama started putting things away. I half sat, half leaned on the sink, and I watched her. Then for a minute there, I got scared, and my belly kind of turned over. Then I realized that I'm into my third month. I've got to tell. Nothing shows yet, but one day Mama's going to give me another sharp look. And then, suddenly, half leaning, half sitting there, watching her, she was at the refrigerator. She looked critically at a chicken and put it away. She was kind of humming under her breath, but the way you hum when your mind is concentrated on something, something painful, just about to come around the corner, just about to hit you. I suddenly had this feeling that she already knew, had known all along, had only been waiting for me to tell her. I said, "Mama?" "Yeah, a little bit." Still humming. But I didn't say anything. So after a minute, she closed the refrigerator door and turned and looked at me. I started to cry. It was her look. She stood there for a minute. She came and put a hand on my forehead and then a hand on my shoulder. She said, "Come on in my room. Your daddy and sis be here soon." We went into her room and sat down on the bed, and Mama closed the door. She didn't touch me. She just sat very still. It was like she had to be very together because I had gone to pieces. She said, "Tish, I declare, I don't think you got nothing to cry about." She moved a little. "You tell Fonny?" "I just told him today. I figured I should tell him first." "You did right. And I bet he just grinned all over his face, didn't he?" I kind of stole a look at her and I laughed. "Yes, he sure did." "You must, let's see. You about 3 months gone?"
"Almost."
"What you crying about?"
Then she did touch me. She took me in her arms, and she rocked me, and I cried. She got me a handkerchief, and I blew my nose. She walked to the window, and she blew hers.
"Now, listen," she said. "You got enough on your mind without worrying about being a bad girl and all that jive-ass shit. I sure hope I raised you better than that. If you was a bad girl, you wouldn't be sitting on that bed. You'd long been turning tricks for the warden."
She came back to the bed and sat down. She seemed to be raking her mind for the right words.
"Tish," she said, "when we was first brought here, the white man, he didn't give us no preachers to say words over us before we had our babies. And you and Fonny be together right now, married or not, wasn't for that same damn white man. So let me tell you what you got to do. You got to think about that baby. You got to hold on to that baby. Don't care what else happens or don't happen. You got to do that. Can't nobody else do that for you. And the rest of us, well, we gonna hold on to you. And we gonna get Fonny out. Don't you worry. I know it's hard. But don't you worry. And that baby be the best thing that ever happened to Fonny. He needs that baby. It's gonna give him a whole lot of courage."
She put one finger under my chin, a trick she has sometimes, and looked me in the eyes, smiling.
"Am I getting through to you, Tish?"
"Yes, Mama. Yes." Now, when your daddy and Ernestine get home, we're going to sit at the table together, and I'll make the family announcement. I think that might be easier, don't you?
Yes. Yes.
She got up from the bed. Take off them streets clothes and lie down for a minute. I'll come get you. She opened the door.
Yes, Mama. Mama?
Yes, Tish.
Thank you, Mama.
She laughed. Well, Tish, daughter, I do not know what you're thanking me for, but you're surely more than welcome. She closed the door and I heard her in the kitchen. I took off my coat and my shoes and lay back on the bed. It was the hour when darkness begins, when the sounds of the night begin. The doorbell rang. I heard Mama yell, "Be right there!" And then she came into the room again. She was carrying a small water glass with a little whiskey in it. "Here, sit up, drink this. Do you good." Then she closed the bedroom door behind her, and I heard her heels along the hall that leads to the front door. It was Daddy. He was in a good mood. I heard his laugh.
"Tish home yet?"
She's taking a little nap inside. She was kind of beat.
"She see Fonny?"
Yeah, she saw Fonny. She saw the inside of the tombs, too. That's why I made her lie down.
"What about the lawyer?"
"She gonna see him Monday." Daddy made a sound. I heard the refrigerator door open and close, and he poured himself a beer.
"Where's Sis?"
"She'll be here. She had to work late."
"How much you think them damn lawyers is gonna cost us before this thing is over?"
"Joe, you know damn well ain't no point in asking me that question."
"Well, they sure got it made, the rotten motherfuckers."
"Amen to that." By now, Mama had poured herself some gin and orange juice and was sitting at the table opposite him. She was swinging her foot. She was thinking ahead. "How'd it go today?"
"All right."
"Daddy works on the docks. He doesn't go to sea anymore." "All right" means that he probably didn't have to curse out more than one or two people all day long, or threaten anybody with death. Fonny gave Mama one of his first pieces of sculpture. This was almost 2 years ago. Something about it always makes me think of Daddy. Mama put it by itself on a small table in the living room. It's not very high. It's done in black wood. It's of a naked man with one hand at his forehead and the other half hiding his sex. The legs are long, and very wide apart, and one foot seems planted, unable to move, and the whole motion of the figure is torment. It seemed a very strange figure for such a young kid to do, or at least, it seemed strange until you thought about it. Fonny used to go to a vocational school where they teach kids to make all kinds of shitty, really useless things, like card tables and hassocks and chests of drawers which nobody's ever going to buy, because who buys handmade furniture? The rich don't do it. They say the kids are dumb, so they're teaching them to work with their hands. Those kids aren't dumb, but the people who run these schools want to make sure that they don't get smart. They are really teaching the kids to be slaves. Fonny didn't go for it at all, and he split, taking most of the wood from the workshop with him. It took him about a week. Tools one day, wood the next. But the wood was a problem because you can't put it in your pocket or under your coat. Finally, he and a friend broke into school after dark, damn near emptied the woodwork shop, and loaded the wood into the friend's brother's car. They hid some of the wood in the basement of a friendly janitor, and Fonny brought the tools to my house, and some of that wood is still under my bed. Fonny had found something that he could do, that he wanted to do, and this saved him from the death that was waiting to overtake the children of our age. Though the death took many forms, though people died early in many different ways, the death itself was very simple, and the cause was simple too, as simple as a plague. The kids had been told that they weren't worth shit, and everything they saw around them proved it. They struggled, but they fell like flies, and they congregated on the garbage heaps of their lives like flies. And perhaps I clung to Fonny. Perhaps Fonny saved me, because he was just about the only boy I knew who wasn't fooling around with the needles or drinking cheap wine or mugging people or holding up stores. And he never got his hair conked. It just stayed nappy. He started working as a short order cook in a barbecue joint so he could eat. And he found a basement where he could work on his wood. And he was at our house more often than he was at his own house. At his house, there was always fighting. Mrs. Hunt couldn't stand Fonny or Fonny's ways. And the two sisters sided with Mrs. Hunt, especially because now they were in terrible trouble. They had been raised to be married, but there wasn't anybody around them good enough for them. They were really just ordinary Harlem girls, even though they'd made it as far as City College. But absolutely nothing was happening for them at City College. Nothing. The brothers with degrees didn't want them. Those who wanted their women black wanted them black, and those who wanted their women white wanted them white. So there they were, and they blamed it all on Fonny. Between the mother's prayers, which were more like curses, and the sister's tears, which were more like orgasms, Fonny didn't stand a chance. Neither was Frank a match for these three hags. He just got angry, and you can just about imagine the shouting that went on in that house. And Frank had started drinking. I couldn't blame him. And sometimes he came to our house, too, pretending that he was looking for Fonny. It was much worse for him than it was for Fonny. And he had lost the tailor shop and was working in the garment center. He had started to depend on Fonny now, the way Fonny had once depended on him. Neither of them, anyway, as you can see, had any other house they could go to. Frank went to bars, but Fonny didn't like bars. That same passion which saved Fonny got him into trouble and put him in jail. For, you see, he had found his center, his own center, inside him, and it showed. He wasn't anybody's nigger, and that's a crime in this fucking free country. You're supposed to be somebody's nigger, and if you're nobody's nigger, you're a bad nigger. And that's what the cops decided when Fonny moved downtown. Ernestine has come in with her bony self. I can hear her teasing Daddy. She works with kids in a settlement house way downtown. Kids up to the age of 14 or so, all colors, boys and girls. It's very hard work, but she digs it. I guess if she didn't dig it, she couldn't do it. It's funny about people. When Ernestine was little, she was as vain could be. She always had her hair curled, and her dresses were always clean, and she was always in front of that damn mirror, like she just could not believe how beautiful she was. I hated her. Since she was nearly 4 years older than me, she considered me beneath her notice. We fought like cats and dogs, or maybe it was more like two bitches. Mama tried not to worry too much about it. She figured that Sis, I called her Sis as a way of calling her out of her name, and also maybe as a way of claiming her, was probably cut out for show business and would end up on the stage. This thought did not fill her heart with joy, but she had to remember my mother, Sharon, that she had once tried to be a singer. All of a sudden, It almost seemed like from one day to the next, all that changed. Sis got tall, for one thing, tall and skinny. She took to wearing slacks and tying up her hair, and she started reading books like books were going out of style. Whenever I'd come home from school and she was there, she'd be curled up on something or lying on the floor, reading. She stopped reading newspapers. She stopped going to the movies. "I don't need no more of the white man's lying shit," she said. "He's fucked with my mind enough already." At the same time, she didn't become rigid or unpleasant, and she didn't talk, not for a long time anyway, about what she read. She got to be much nicer to me, and her face began to change. It became bonier and more private, much more beautiful. Her long, narrow eyes darkened with whatever it was they were beginning to see. She gave up her plans for going to college and worked for a while in a hospital. She met a little girl in that hospital. The little girl was dying, and at the age of 12, she was already a junkie. And this wasn't a black girl. She was Puerto Rican. And then Ernestine started working with children. "Where's Jezebel?" Sis started calling me Jezebel after I got my job at the perfume center of the department store where I work now. The store thought that it was very daring, very progressive, to give this job to a colored girl. I stand behind that damn counter all day long, smile until my back teeth ache, letting tired old ladies smell the back of my hand. Sis claimed that I came home smelling like a Louisiana whore. "She's home. She's lying down." "She all right?" "She's tired. She went to see Fonny." "How's Fonny taking it?"
"Taking it? Lord, let me make myself a drink. You want me to cook?"
"No, I'll get into the pots in a minute."
"She see Mr. Hayward?"
"Arnold Hayward is the lawyer. Sis found him for me through the settlement house, which has been forced, after all, to have some dealings with lawyers." "No, she's seeing him on Monday after work."
"You going with her?"
"I think I better."
"Yeah, I think so, too. Daddy, you better stop putting down that beer. You're getting to be as big as a house. And I'll call him from work before you all get there. You want a shot of gin in that beer, old man?"
"Just put it on the side, daughter dear, before I stand up."
"Stand up? Here."
"And tan your hide. You better listen to Aretha when she sings Respect. You know, Tish says she thinks that lawyer wants more money."
"Daddy, we paid him his retainer. That's why ain't none of us got no clothes. And I know we got to pay expenses, but he ain't supposed to get no more money until he brings Fonny to trial."
"He says it's a tough case."
"Shit. What's a lawyer for?"
"To make money," Mama said.
"Well, anybody talked to the Hunts lately?"
"They don't want to know nothing about it, you know that. Mrs. Hunt and them two camellias is just in disgrace, and poor Frank ain't got no money."
"Well, let's not talk too much about it in front of Tish. We'll work it out somehow."
"Shit, we got to work it out. Fonny's like one of us."
"He is one of us," said Mama. I turned on the lights in Mama's bedroom so they'd know I was up. And I looked at myself in the mirror. I kind of patted my hair and I walked into the kitchen.
"Well," said Sis, "although I cannot say that your beauty rest did you a hell of a lot of good, I do admire the way you persevere."
Mama said that if we wanted to eat, we'd better get our behinds out of her kitchen. And so we went into the living room. I sat on the hassock, leaning on Daddy's knee. Now it was 7 o'clock and the streets were full of noises. I felt very quiet after my long day, and my baby began to be real to me. I don't mean that it hadn't been real before, but now, in a way, I was alone with it. Sis had left the lights very low. She put on a Ray Charles record and sat down on the sofa. I listened to the music and the sounds from the streets, and Daddy's hand rested lightly on my hair. And everything seemed connected. The street sounds, and Ray's voice and his piano, and my daddy's hand, and my sister's silhouette, and the sounds and the lights coming from the kitchen. It was as though we were a picture, trapped in time. This had been happening for hundreds of years. People sitting in a room, waiting for dinner, and listening to the blues. And it was as though, out of these elements, this patience, my daddy's touch, the sounds of my mother in the kitchen, the way the light fell, the way the music continued beneath everything, the movement of Ernestine's head as she lit a cigarette, the movement of her hand as she dropped the match into the ashtray, the blurred human voices rising from the street out of this rage and a steady, somehow triumphant sorrow. My baby was slowly being formed. I wondered if it would have Fonny's eyes, as someone had wondered, not after all so very long ago, about the eyes of Joseph, my father, whose hand rested on my head. What struck me suddenly, more than anything else, was something I knew but hadn't looked at. This was Fonny's baby and mine. We had made it together. It was both of us. I didn't know either of us very well. What would both of us be like? But this somehow made me think of Fonny and made me smile. My father rubbed his hand over my forehead. I thought of Fonny's touch, of Fonny in my arms. His breath, his touch, his odor, his weight, that terrible and beautiful presence riding into me, and his breath being snarled as if by a golden thread deeper and deeper in his throat as he rode deeper and deeper, not so much into me as into a kingdom which lay just behind his eyes. He worked on wood that way. He worked on stone that way. If I had never seen him work, I might never have known he loved me. It's a miracle to realize that somebody loves you. Tish? Ernestine, gesturing with her cigarette. Yes? What time you seeing the lawyer on Monday? After the 6 o'clock visit, I'll be there about 7. He says he's got to work late anyway. If he says anything about more money, you tell him to call me, you hear? I don't know what good that's going to do. If he wants more money, he wants more money.
You do like your sister tells you, Daddy said.
He won't talk to you, Ernestine said. The way he'll talk to me. Can you dig it? Yes, I said, finally. I can dig it. But for reasons I couldn't explain, something in her voice frightened me to death. I felt the way I'd felt all day, alone with my trouble. Nobody could help me, not even Sis, because she was certainly determined to help me. I knew that. But maybe I realized that she was frightened, too. Although she was trying to sound calm and tough, I realized that she knew a whole lot about it because of the kids downtown. I wanted to ask her how it worked. I wanted to ask her if it worked. When there's nobody but us, we eat in the kitchen, which is maybe the most important room in our house, the room where everything happens. where things begin and take their shape and end. Now, when supper was over that night, Mama went to the cupboard and came back with an old bottle, a bottle she's had for years, a very old French brandy. They came from her days as a singer, her days with the drummer. This was the last bottle. It hadn't been opened yet. She put the bottle on the table in front of Joseph, and she said, "Open it." She got four glasses, and then she stood there while he opened it. Ernestine and Joseph looked like they just couldn't guess what had got into Mama, but I knew what she was doing, and my heart jumped up. Daddy got the bottle open. Mama said, "You the man of the house, Joe. Start pouring." It's funny about people. Just before something happens, you almost know what it is. You do know what it is, I believe. You just haven't had the time. And now you won't have the time to say it to yourself. Daddy's face changed in a way I can't describe. His face became as definite as stone. Every line and angle suddenly seemed chiseled, and his eyes turned a blacker black. He was waiting, suddenly, helplessly, for what was already known to be translated, to enter reality. To be born. Sis watched Mama with her eyes very calm, her eyes very long and narrow, smiling a little. No one looked at me. I was there, then, for them, in a way that had nothing to do with me. I was there, then, for them, like Fonny was present, like my baby, just beginning now. Out of a long, long sleep to turn, to listen, to awaken, somewhere beneath my heart. Daddy poured, and Mama gave us each a glass. She looked at Joseph, then at Ernestine, then at me. She smiled at me. "This is a sacrament," she said. "And no, I ain't gone crazy. We're drinking to a new life. Tish is going to have Fonny's baby." She touched Joseph. "Drink," she said. Daddy wet his lips, staring at me. It was like no one could speak before he spoke. I stared at him. I didn't know what he was going to say. Joseph put his glass down. Then he picked it up again. He was trying to speak. He wanted to speak. But he couldn't. And he looked at me as if he was trying to find out something. Something my face would tell him. A strange smile wavered just around his face. Not yet in his face. And he seemed to be traveling backward and forward at once in time. He said,
"That's a hell of a note."
Then he drank some more brandy, and he said,
"Ain't you gonna drink to the little one, Tish?"
I swallowed a little brandy, and I coughed, and Ernestine patted me on the back. Then she took me in her arms. She had tears on her face. She smiled down at me, but she didn't say anything.
"How long this been going on?"
Daddy asked. "About 3 months," Mama said. "Yeah, that's what I figure," said Ernestine, surprising me.
3 months,
Daddy said, as though 5 months or 2 months would have made some kind of difference and made more sense. "Since March," I said. Fonny had been arrested in March.
"While you two was running around looking at places so you could get married," Daddy said.
His face was full of questions, and he would have been able to ask these questions of his son, or at least I think that a black man can, but he couldn't ask these questions of his daughter. For a moment, I was almost angry. Then I wasn't. Fathers and sons are one thing. Fathers and daughters are another. It doesn't do to look too hard into this mystery, which is as far from being simple as it is from being safe. We don't know enough about ourselves. I think it's better to know that you don't know. That way you can grow with the mystery as the mystery grows in you. But these days, of course, everybody knows everything. That's why so many people are lost. But I wondered how Frank would take the news that his son, Fonny, was about to be a father. Then I realized that the first thing everybody thought was, but Fonny's in jail. Frank would think that. That would be his first thought. Frank would think, if anything happens, my boy won't never see his baby. And Joseph thought, if anything happens, my little girl's baby won't have no father. Yes. That was the thought, unspoken, which stiffened the air in our kitchen. And I felt that I should say something, but I was too tired. I leaned against Ernestine's shoulder. I had nothing to say.
You sure you want this baby, Tish?
My father asked me. Oh, yes, I said. And Fonny wants it too. It's our baby, I said. Don't you see? And it's not Fonny's fault that he's in jail. It's not as though he ran away or anything. And this was the only way I could answer the questions he hadn't asked. We've always been best friends, ever since we were little. You know that? And we'd be married now if...
Your father know that, Mama said. He's only worried about you. Don't you go thinking I think you a bad girl, or any foolishness like that, Daddy said. I just asked you that because you're so young, that's all, and...
It's rough, but we'll make it, Ernestine said. She knows Daddy better than I do. I think it's because she's felt since we were children that our Daddy maybe loved me more than he loves her. This isn't true, and she knows that now people love different people in different ways. But it must have seemed that way to her when we were little. I look as though I just can't make it. She looks like can't nothing stop her. If you look helpless, people react to you in one way. And if you look strong, or just come on strong, people react to you in another way. And since you don't see what they see, this can be very painful. I think that's maybe why Sis was always in front of that damn mirror all the time when we were kids. She was saying, I don't care. I got me. Of course, this only made her come on stronger than ever, which was the last effect she desired. But that's the way we are, and that's how we can sometimes get so fucked up. Anyway, she's past all that. She knows who she is, or at least she knows who she damn well isn't. And since she's no longer terrified of uprisings in those forces which she lives with and has learned how to use and subdue, she can walk straight ahead into anything. And so she can cut Daddy off when he's talking, which I can't do. She moved away from me a little and put my glass in my hand. Unbow your head, sister, she said, and raised her glass and touched mine. Save the children, she said, very quietly, and drained her glass. Mama said, to the newborn. And Daddy said,
I hope it's a boy. That'd tickle old Frank to pieces, I bet.
Then he looked at me.
Do you mind?
He asked me.
If I'm the one to tell him, Tish?
I said, no, I don't mind.
Well, then, he said, grinning, maybe I'll go on over there now.
Maybe you better phone first, Mama said. He don't stay home a whole lot, you know. I sure would like to be the one to tell them sisters, said Ernestine.
Mama laughed and said, Joe, why don't you just call up and ask them all over here? Hell, it's Saturday night and it ain't late and we still got a lot of brandy in the bottle. And now that I think about it, it's really the best way to do it.
That's all right with you, Tish?
Daddy asked me. It's got to be done, I said. So, Daddy stood up after watching me for a moment and walked into the living room to the phone. He could have used the wall phone in the kitchen, but he had had that kind of grim smile on his face, which he has when he knows he's got business to take care of and when he wants to make sure you know enough to stay out of it. We listened to him dialing the number. That was the only sound in the house. Then we could hear the phone at the other end ringing. Daddy cleared his throat. We heard,
Mrs. Hunt? Oh. Good evening, Mrs. Hunt. This is Joe Rivers talking. I just wondered if I could please speak to Frank if he's home. Thank you, Mrs. Hunt.
Mama grunted and winked at Sis.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, this is Joe. I'm all right, man, hanging in, you know. Say, listen. Oh, yeah, Tish saw him this afternoon. Man, he's fine. Yeah. As a matter of fact, man, we got a whole lot to talk about. That's why I'm calling you. I can't go into all that over the phone, man. Listen, it concerns all of us. Yes, listen, don't give me all that noise. You all just jump in the car and come on over here. Now. Yeah, that's right, now. What? Look, man, I said it concerns all of us. Ain't nobody here dressed neither. She can come in her fucking bathrobe for all I care. Shut up, you sick mother. I'm trying to be nice. Shit. Don't be bitter. Just dump her in the back seat of the car and drive. Now, come on, man, this is serious. Hey, pick up a six-pack. I'll pay you when you get here. Yeah. Look, will you hang up this phone and get your ass, I mean, your collective ass, on over here, man? In a minute. Bye.
He came back into the kitchen, smiling.
Mrs. Hunt is getting dressed, he said, and sat down.
Then he looked over at me. He smiled, a wonderful smile.
Come on over here, Tish, he said. And sit down on your daddy's knee.
I felt like a princess. I swear I did. He took me in his arms and settled me on his lap and kissed me on the forehead and rubbed his hand at first roughly and then very gently through my hair.
You're a good girl, Clementine, he said. I'm proud of you. Don't you forget that.
She ain't gonna forget it, said Ernestine. I'll whip her ass.
But she's pregnant, Mama cried and took a sip of her cognac and then we all cracked up.
My father's chest shook with laughter. I felt his chest rising and falling between my shoulder blades, and this laughter contained a furious joy, an unspeakable relief. In spite of all that hung above our heads, I was his daughter, all right. I had found someone to love, and I was loved, and he was released and verified. That child in my belly was also, after all, his child, too, for there would have been no Tish if there had been no Joseph. Our laughter in that kitchen then was our helpless response to a miracle. That baby was our baby. It was on its way. My father's great hand on my belly held it and warmed it. In spite of all that hung above our heads, that child was promised safety. Love had sent it, spinning out of us to us. Where that might take us, no one knew. But now my father, Joe, was ready. In a deadlier and more profound way than his daughters were, this child was the seed of his loins. And no knife could cut him off from life until that child was born. And I almost felt the child feel this. That child which had no movement yet. I almost felt it leap against my father's hand, kicking upward against my ribs. Something in me sang and hummed, and then I felt the deadly morning sickness, and I dropped my head onto my father's shoulder. He held me. It was very silent. The nausea passed. Sharon watched it all, smiling, swinging her foot, thinking ahead. Again, she winked at Ernestine.
"Shall we," asked Ernestine, rising, "dress for Mrs. Hunt?"
And we all cracked up again. "Look, we gotta be nice," said Joseph.
"We'll be nice," said Ernestine. "Lord knows we'll be nice. You raised us right. You just didn't ever buy us no clothes," she said to Mama. "But Mrs. Hunt now and them sisters, they got wardrobes. Ain't no sense in trying to compete with them," she said despairingly, and sat down.
"I didn't run no tailor shop," said Joseph, and looked into my eyes and smiled.
The very first time Fanny and I made love was strange. It was strange because we had both seen it coming. That is not exactly the way to put it. We had not seen it coming. Abruptly, it was there. And then we knew that it had always been there, waiting. We had not seen the moment, but the moment had seen us, from a long ways off, sat there, waiting for us, utterly free, the moment, playing cards, hurling thunderbolts, cracking spines, tremendously waiting for us, dawdling home from school to keep our appointment. Look. I dumped water over Fanny's head and scrubbed Fanny's back in the bathtub, in a time that seems a long time ago now. I swear I don't remember seeing his sex. And yet, of course, I must have. We never played doctor, and yet I had played this rather terrifying game with other boys, and Fanny had certainly played with other girls and boys. I don't remember that we ever had any curiosity concerning each other's bodies at all, due to the cunning of that watching moment which knew we were approaching. Fanny loved me too much. We needed each other too much. We were a part of each other. Flesh of each other's flesh, which meant that we so took each other for granted that we never thought of the flesh. He had legs and I had legs. That wasn't all we knew, but that was all we used. They brought us up the stairs and down the stairs and always to each other. But that meant that there had never been any occasion for shame between us. I was flat-chested for a very long time. I'm only beginning to have real breasts now because of the baby, in fact, and I still don't have any hips. Fanny liked me so much that it didn't occur to him that he loved me. I liked him so much that no other boy was real to me. I didn't see them. I didn't know what this meant. But the waiting moment, which had spied us on the road and which was waiting for us, knew. Fanny kissed me goodnight one night when he was 21 and I 18, and I felt his sex jerk against me, and he moved away. I said goodnight and I ran up the stairs and he ran down the stairs. And I couldn't sleep that night. Something had happened, and he didn't come around. I didn't see him for 2 or 3 weeks. That was when he did that wood figure which he gave to Mama. The day he gave it to her was a Saturday. After he gave the figure to Mama, we left the house and we walked around. I was so happy to see him after so long that I was ready to cry. And everything was different. I was walking through streets I had never seen before. The faces around me I had never seen. We moved in a silence which was music from everywhere. Perhaps for the first time in my life, I was happy, and I knew that I was happy. And Fanny held me by the hand. It was like that Sunday morning so long ago when his mother had carried us to church. Fanny had no part in his hair now. It was heavy all over his head. He had no blue suit. He had no suit at all. He was wearing an old black and red lumber jacket and old gray corduroy pants. His heavy shoes were scuffed, and he smelled of fatigue. He was the most beautiful person I had seen in all my life. He has a slow, long-legged, bow-legged walk. We walked down the stairs to the subway train, he holding me by the hand. The train, when it came, was crowded, and he put an arm around me for protection. I suddenly looked up into his face. No one can describe this. I really shouldn't try. His face was bigger than the world. His eyes deeper than the sun, more vast than the desert. All that had ever happened since time began was in his face. He smiled, a little smile. I saw his teeth. I saw exactly where the missing tooth had been that day he spat in my mouth. The train rocked. He held me closer. And a kind of sigh I'd never heard before stifled itself in him. It's astounding the first time you realize that a stranger has a body. The realization that he has a body makes him a stranger. It means that you have a body, too. You will live with this forever, and it will spell out the language of your life. And it was absolutely astonishing to me to realize that I was a virgin. I really was. I suddenly wondered how. I wondered why. But it was because I had always, without ever thinking about it, known that I would spend my life with Fanny. It simply had not entered my mind that my life could do anything else. This meant that I was not merely a virgin. I was still a child. We got off the train at Sheridan Square in the village. We walked east along West 4th Street. Since it was Saturday, the streets were crowded, unbalanced with the weight of people. Most of them were young. They had to be young. You could see that, but they didn't seem young to me. They frightened me. I could not then have said why. I thought it was because they knew so much more than me. And they did. But in another way, which I'm only beginning to understand now, they didn't. They had it all together, the walk, the sound, the laughter, the untidy clothes, clothes which were copies of a poverty as unimaginable for them as theirs was inexpressibly remote from me. There were many blacks and white together. It was hard to tell which was the imitation. They were so free that they believed in nothing, and didn't realize that this illusion was their only truth and that they were doing exactly as they had been told. Fanny looked over at me. It was getting to be between 6 and 7. You all right?
Sure. You?
You want to eat down here, or you want to wait till we get back uptown? Or you want to go to the movies? Or you want a little wine or a little pot? Or a beer, or a cup of coffee. Or you just want to walk a little more before you make up your mind.
He was grinning, warm and sweet.
and pulling a little against my hand and swinging it. I was very happy, but I was uncomfortable too. I had never been uncomfortable with him before. Let's walk to the park first. I somehow wanted to stay outside a while.
Okay.
And he still had that funny smile on his face, like something wonderful had just happened to him, and no one in the world knew anything about it yet but him. But he would tell somebody soon, and it would be me. We crossed crowded Sixth Avenue, all kinds of people out hunting for Saturday night. But nobody looked at us because we were together and we were both black. Later, when I had to walk these streets alone, it was different. The people were different, and I was certainly no longer a child. "Let's go this way," he said. And we started down Sixth Avenue toward Bleecker Street. We started down Bleecker, and Fonny stared for a moment through the big window of the San Remo. There was no one in there that he knew, and the whole place looked tired and discouraged, as though wearily about to shave and get dressed for a terrible evening. The people under the weary light were veterans of indescribable wars. We kept walking. The streets were very crowded now, with youngsters, black and white, and cops. Fonny held his head a little higher, and his grip tightened on my hand. There were lots of kids on the sidewalk before the crowded coffee shop. A jukebox was playing Aretha's That's Life. It was strange. Everyone was in the streets, moving and talking, like people do everywhere, and yet none of it seemed to be friendly. There was something hard and frightening about it. The way that something which looks real but isn't can send you screaming out of your mind. It was just like scenes uptown, in a way, with the older men and women sitting on the stoops, with small children running up and down the block, cars moving slowly through this maelstrom, the cop car parked on the corner with the two cops in it, other cops swaggering slowly along the sidewalk. It was like scenes uptown, in a way, but with something left out, or something put in, I couldn't tell. But it was a scene that frightened me. One had to make one's way carefully here, for all these people were blind. We were jostled, and Fonny put his arm around my shoulder. We passed Minetta Tavern, crossed Minetta Lane, passed the newspaper stand on the next corner, and crossed diagonally into the park, which seemed to huddle in the shadow of the heavy new buildings of NYU and the high new apartment buildings on the east and the north. We passed the men who had been playing chess in the lamplight for generations, and people walking their dogs, and young men with bright hair and very tight pants who looked quickly at Fonny and resignedly at me. We sat down on the stone edge of the dry fountain, facing the arch. There were lots of people around us, but I still felt this terrible lack of friendliness.
"I've slept in this park sometimes," said Fonny. "It's not a good idea."
He lit a cigarette.
"You want a cigarette?"
"Not now." I had wanted to stay outside for a while, but now I wanted to get in, away from these people, out of the park. "Why did you sleep in the park?"
"It was late. I didn't want to wake up my folks, and I didn't have no bread."
"You could have came to our house."
"Well, I didn't want to wake up none of you neither."
He put his cigarettes back into his pocket.
"But I got me a pad down here now. I'll show it to you later. You want to see it?"
He looked at me.
"You getting cold and tired. I'll get you something to eat, okay?"
"Okay. You got money?"
"Yeah, I hustled me up a little change, baby. Come on."
We did a lot of walking that night, because now Fonny took me way west, along Greenwich, past the Women's House of Detention, to this little Spanish restaurant, where Fonny knew all the waiters and they all knew him. And these people were different from the people in the street. Their smiles were different, and I felt at home. It was Saturday, but it was early, and they put us at a small table in the back. Not as though they didn't want people to see us, but as though they were glad we'd come and wanted us to stay as long as possible. I hadn't had much experience in restaurants, but Fonny had. He spoke a little Spanish, too, and I could see that the waiters were teasing him about me. And then I remembered, as I was being introduced to our waiter, Pedrocito, which meant that he was the youngest, that we had been called on the block Romeo and Juliet. People had always teased us, but not like this. Some days, I took off, when I could see him in the middle of the day, and then again at 6, I'd walk from Center Street to Greenwich, and I'd sit in the back, and they'd feed me, very silently and carefully making sure that I ate something. More than once, Luisito, who had just arrived from Spain and who could barely speak English, took away the cold omelet which he had cooked and which I had not touched, and brought me a new hot one, saying, "Señorita, por favor, he and the muchacho need your strength. You'll not forgive us if we let you starve. We are his friends. He trusts us. You must trust us, too." He would pour me a little red wine. "Wine is good. Slowly." I would take a sip. He would smile, but he would not move until I began to eat. Then,
"It will be a boy," he said,
and grinned and moved away. They got me through many and many a terrible day. They were the very nicest people I had met in all New York. They cared. When the going got rough, when I was heavy, with Joseph and Frank and Sharon working and Ernestine in battle, they would arrange to have errands in the neighborhood of the tombs, and as though it were the most natural thing in the world, which it was for them, drive me to their restaurant, and then they would drive me back down for the 6 o'clock visit. I will never forget them. Never. They knew. But on this particular Saturday night, we did not know. Fonny did not know, and we were happy, all of us. I had one margarita, though we all knew that this was against the goddamn motherfucking shit-eating law, and Fonny had a whiskey, because at 21 you have a legal right to drink. His hands are big. He took my hands and put his hands in mine.
"I want to show you something later," he said.
I could not tell whose hands were trembling, which hands were holding. "Okay," I said. He had ordered paella, and when it came, we unjoined our hands, and Fonny elaborately served me.
"Next time it's your turn," he said,
and we laughed and began to eat. And we had wine, and there were candles. And other people came, looking at us strangely, but
"We know the cats who owned the joint," Fonny said,
and we laughed again, and we were safe. I had never seen Fonny outside of the world in which I moved. I had seen him with his father and his mother and his sisters, and I had seen him with us, but I'm not sure now that I think about it that I had ever really seen him with me. Not until this moment, when we were leaving the restaurant and all the waiters were laughing and talking with him in Spanish and in English, and Fonny's face opened in a way I'd never seen it open. And that laugh of his came rumbling up from his balls.